All right. We have Avraham Ibn Ezra, Legends and Lessons. You know that street? Is there a street in Israel? I don't remember. Okay, I'm sure there is. Avraham Ibn Ezra is a fascinating character, and unfortunately, I can't find my notes from it, but I have a few printouts of what I probably based my notes on. So we'll work through it a little bit together, and then we'll go into his actual commentary. Ibn Ezra, you might be familiar with the Ibn Ezra just from around. The Ibn Ezra said this. The Ibn Ezra explains that. He is one of the classic commentaries that you'll find in the Mikraot Gedolos Chumashim. This is a newer version of that, but inside it looks pretty similar. Right? This is a Mikraot Gedolos Chumash. The Chumash up here, Rashi over here, and Ibn Ezra is usually right. Not too far beneath. It's usually a little shorter than Rashi, but we'll get there. We'll get there soon. The reason why he's interesting is he, in many ways, represents a era of the Jewish people, an era in which not only the Jewish people had a semblance of freedom, but also a semblance of secular expertise. Don't tell some Jews this. But in Spain, the Jewish rabbis, the scholars of Spain, the Ramban, the Rambam, and the Ibn Ezra, were experts in science and math and language, and in the Ibn Ezra's case, poetry. He was a poet. The Ibn Ezra was a poet, literally wrote poems. And oftentimes his poems had nothing to do with Judaism. He was just wrote poems about what he saw in the world. Now those things don't make it, you know, very far in the Jewish curricula. But the point is that he was literally a secular poet.
And what language would he have written?
So that's an interesting point. Oftentimes he wrote in Judeo-Arabic, but he also translated a lot and wrote a lot in biblical Hebrew. It wouldn't be the Hebrew you and I would write in, just like commentaries on the Chumash wouldn't use modern uses of Hebrew words, but that's because, you know, Eliezer ben Yehuda came up with a whole new language, basically, just using Hebrew words from the Bible and making new words and whatever. But let's rewind a little bit. Eliezer ben Yehuda, Eliezer Avraham ben Ezra was actually not the son of someone named Ezra. He was known as Ibn Ezra because he came probably from a patriarch of some kind. Hi, Michael.
Hi.
I don't remember who Ezra himself was, but one of his ancestors, I don't know if it's his grandfather, great-grandfather, his name was Ezra. The word Ibn in Arabic means son of. So it is interesting. If you look at a lot of the, you won't find it in here. If you look at some of the Chumashim, you'll find that the acronym for the Ibn Ezra is Resh Aleph Beis Ayin, which would stand, theoretically, would stand for Rabbi Eliezer ben Ezra, which is entirely incorrect. Ibn Ezra is somewhat of a last name almost. I don't know if people know here, anyone here with the last name with the word Ben in front of it. I don't know. I knew someone whose last name was Ben Avraham. Like, in growing up, there was a guy, his name was Ben Avraham, so-and-so Ben Avraham. That wasn't his father's name, that was his last name. So Ibn Ezra was many ways just like a last name. So the acronym doesn't really work if it's a last name, because it's not really his name or his father's name. Either way, so he's born in either 1089 or 1092. Just to put perspective on that, this is a time in really Spanish Jewry that we don't know much about. Rashi lives and learns in France, Germany, Provence, and his dates are 1035 to 1104, right? So he overlaps with the Ibn Ezra, but in terms of rabbis in Spain, we have one contemporary of his, who we'll talk about soon, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. We have, who wrote the Kuzari, if you're familiar. He's famous for the Libi b'Mizrach, Ani b'Toch Ma'arav. Right? He wrote very longingly of the land of Israel. And they were friends, even though Rabbi Yehuda Halevi was an elder friend of his. But nonetheless, we don't know much of the other Spanish rabbis at the time. It would seem, and this is a bold statement, I'm not going to pretend like this is true, but it would seem that maybe the rabbinic traditions of Sephardic rabbis didn't really produce the same level of caliber that it was in the German rabbinic schools, right? We think about the 11th century. We know a lot more rabbis that came from the 11th century than we do Spanish rabbis. I'm sure there were worse Spanish rabbis. I'm not saying there weren't. But in terms of the prominent ones that make the papers, literally that make books, we don't know many. The Ibn Ezra is really one of the first. The next big, we know Rabbi Yehuda Halevi wrote the Kuzari, but that's not really a commentary, so it didn't really make it into sort of the mainstream study of Jews around the world, although it's obviously a very popular book. But in terms of commentaries on the Chumash, on Gemara, we don't really have many. I'm sure there are that I'm just not aware of, but there aren't many that made it into the mainstream before the Ibn Ezra. I don't know of any that made it into the mainstream before the Ibn Ezra. The only commentary, in fact, that we know of is Rashi. Now, Rashi had grandchildren whose commentaries to the Talmud had already become popular before the Ibn Ezra also, but in terms of commentaries to the Chumash, there really aren't others. The next most popular commentary is probably the Ramban, with a nun at the end. The Ramban lived, I believe he was born in 1194. So this is 100 years before the Ramban. So when we talk about the Ibn Ezra as a Spanish rabbi, a rabbi from Sfarad, we are not talking about a typical, sort of a traditional Spanish rabbi chain, right? The Spanish rabbis that we know of, the Rambam, the Ramban, the Rashba, the Ritva, the Ran, the Rivash, even the Rush, if you want to count him, the Balaturim, those, they follow a very specific chain of command or chain of tradition that we're familiar with. We would call them the Chachmei Sfarad. I'm not sure the Ibn Ezra would fall in that category. He's born in 1090, right? 1090 is even before the Germanic communities of spireworms and mines were decimated, right? It's only 6 years before the First Crusade. The Crusades don't make it to Spain, which is why, you know, Spain takes off as the headquarters of Jewry, as we know it, at least retrospectively. But the point is that the Ibn Ezra really predates, in many ways, the classic Chachmei Sfarad, the classic rabbis of Spain, at least the chain that we're familiar with. Nonetheless, he is perhaps the most prominent and symbolic representative of the life of Jews in Spain. He had an education in multiple languages. He knew mathematics. He knew sciences. We have poems talking about, you know, astronomy from him. He was a very well-educated, not just in Torah, but in sciences. Now, that also lends to a level of unique philosophy, if you will, which some people are not so fond of. He makes a couple claims in his commentaries to the Chumash, which maybe are not so mainstream. They do not carry over to the other Spanish rabbis. The Rambam does not continue that traditions of the Ibn Ezra, despite the fact that Ibn Ezra was perhaps the first rationalist to approach Torah. He looked at it in a very scientific and calculating way. Nonetheless, the Ibn Ezra himself was his own breed. The only thing that he shared with Rabbi Yehuda Halevi was the sort of the poetry. We're going to be jumping around a little bit because we don't really have a chronology of his life so much. But not a specific necessarily, but a methodology. The Ibn Ezra will look at a pasuk from Chumash and make it make sense based on grammar. Whereas Rashi, when looking at a pasuk in Chumash, the first book Rashi picks up is the Midrash, which is ironic because Rashi tells us he's not here to tell you drash, he's here to tell you the pshat, but then almost every Rashi is always drash, right? Almost every time you look at a Rashi, it's like, oh, Midrash Rabbah, Michilta, you know, Gemara, right? He's always quoting from the Midrashim. But nonetheless, Rashi's whole point was that he was going to be a Pashtan, one of those who are trying to just teach us the literal understanding of the Pesukim. You know, that irony leads to his own grandson, the Rashbam, ultimately writing another parish, which he claims would have been Rashi's more accurate parish, as he claims Rashi told him. Okay. Either way, the Ibn Ezra is unabashedly literal. He will analyze the grammar and understand the grammar. I don't know the Ibn Ezra commentary well enough to make any bold claims, but I would be surprised if the Ibn Ezra ever even quotes Chazal more than 5% of the time. He just straight shot, straight understand the words, what do the words mean, and try to understand the words based on that. Other precedents or antecedents in Tanakh. The word antecedent is a bad word because Chumash comes before all of it. But you know what I'm saying. You know, borrowing other psukim from other places to understand what the words mean. And that's the probable cause of that approach is growing up in a literature-rich society like Spain, where people valued poetry, they valued the written word, and he made his life doing that. It is also no surprise, therefore, to realize that he didn't write that commentary until much later in life. But let's get there. We'll try to do the best we can, try to piece together some of his stories here. So he's born in Tudela, Spain, and he apparently, we don't really know much about his upbringing. We don't know much about his training. We don't even know much about his family. We have one reference based on a commentary apparently that he made that he had either 3 or 5 kids, but what we do know is that only one of them survived, and that one converted to Islam. Yeah, you read up on him or something? Yeah. So we know that, and we also know that he goes into exile, basically. He starts wandering around. I always thought, and I don't remember if I learned this from a book. I was trying to find the book. Maybe I took it somewhere, but I always thought that he had left Spain because of persecution, because of some kind of maybe the Almohads or some kind of Islamic rule that pushed him out. I couldn't find that. It sounds almost as if he was distraught over his son that converted. That's what it sounds like from a couple instances, a couple examples. But nonetheless, he ends up wandering around to other places in the general area. He's generally nearby. I mean, he goes to other places in Spain. He goes to Cordova. And I think he goes with Rabbi Yehuda Levi to Cordova, despite the fact that Rabbi Yehuda Levi was like 14 years older than him, potentially could be 11 years older than him. Either way. He then apparently also debated with the Karaites. I'm not really sure why or how we know that. This is just some snippets from the Jewish Encyclopedia, because again, I lost my notes. But again, we don't know much about his family. We know about his son, and we know that he wrote poems while he was traveling. We know he actually got to Baghdad at some point, which was very far off the beaten path. He does, even if it wasn't necessarily what caused him to wander, he does write a few different poems grieving for the loss of his son, or at least the loss of his son's religiosity. So most likely, the Ibn Ezra left Spain in the 1130s, maybe 1140. Apparently, he was trying to go find his son to bring him back to Judaism. It didn't help. He ends up in Italy, in Rome. And then, so he's, what, 50 years old now? But still, for the next few decades, he starts to write a lot. This is when, after he wanders, he gets in Rome, and he starts to write a lot. He writes these poems. He writes, also starts writing commentaries. I don't know what happened to his wife. Obviously, he had kids with his wife, but it seems like he's on his own almost when he goes off in around 1140. He starts with Kohelet, which is, I thought, ironic. Apparently, the commentary to Kohelet starts, he departed from his native place, which is in Spain, and came to Rome. So we know that that's why he wrote his Kohelet commentary, which is only when he was 50 years old. I don't know about that. He was very close to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. They were from the same town, so it could very well be. It could be that they were related, or that he married in. We know that he made his way to Egypt at some point, and to North Africa at some point. It could very well be that he was in Africa with Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. But yeah, he traveled a lot, so much so that not only did he travel to Africa and Spain, he actually travels to France and Provence, which is interesting because then you have a cross-cultural transfer, right? Much like the Rush and the Balaturim, his son, who go from Germany to Spain, he is going from Spain to France. And legend has it that he met none other than Rashi's grandson, perhaps the most well-known of Rashi's grandsons, Rabbeinu Tam, Rabbi Yaakov ben Meir. And I don't know if he writes about him or he has some kind of glowing reference to him in one of his poems or something, I think I saw. Yeah, I'm not 100% sure. According to the Jewish Encyclopedia, it says, in northern France, Ibn Ezra came into contact with the celebrated grandson of Rashi, Rabbeinu Tam, and the poem in praise of his brother, Rav Shmuel ben Meir, that's the Rashbam, written there by Ibn Ezra, has been preserved, meaning that we know we have a poem that he wrote about Rav Shmuel ben Meir, which, you know, not to inject too much of my own interpretation into it, but it would make sense that the Ibn Ezra and the Rashbam got along together. They were both literalists that tried to understand the Pshat without understanding it with Midrash. The Rashbam says that his grandfather Rashi, he did too much drash, and the Ibn Ezra did the same thing. He tried to limit the amount of drash that he involved. Apparently, one of his major contributions once he gets to these other places is to bring the wisdom, the secular wisdom that he had in Spain, to the Jews. One of the ways he does that is a couple of different things. He has apparently a translation of a famous book of astronomy, meaning it was written in Arabic. Maybe the Jews weren't so well-versed in Arabic, so he translated it into Hebrew so that the Jews could learn astronomy, which is just a crazy thing to think, that a commentary in the Chumash is writing a textbook for Jews to learn astronomy. But okay, you know, don't tell the Kollel. But beyond that, he also apparently introduced the decimal system. I don't know how that's possible. We do know that the Arabs of Spain were famous for their mathematics.
Yeah.
And their, something with the letters of the Aleph-Bays, right? Yeah.
For the
zero? Yeah. In front of a dot?
Well, he put that to make it decimal.
So you must have put a decimal, though. You just said you had a zero. I don't know what the zero was. It looked like that.
For the one, for the ten, he had a special symbol.
For the tenth place?
Is that what it just said?
Post-decimal or pre-decimal?
I think
Yeah, I don't know how that works. Either way, so he had this whole system to teach the Jews, imagine that, the famous biblical commentary had taught the Jews math. It's like a funny thing to think about.
Yeah.
It is interesting to know that we don't know much about his expertise in Gemara or Chazal at all.
Mm-hmm.
He is so committed and known for his literary expertise. His commentaries are mostly just grammar. In 1160, he was in Provence and at Narbonne. He translated an astronomical work of Arabic. Ibn Ezra's life ended at the place where the second period of his activity began, Rome, where he put the finishing touches to his commentary and probably also began his last grammatical work, Safarura. I never mentioned his father's name was actually Meir, not Ezra, but either way. He was working on the Safarura. I don't think he ever finished it, but... maybe the Ibn Ezra died in Calahorra, which is in northern Spain. It could be that he was trying to make his way back into Spain. So he has this, apparently he has this poem about himself, sort of like an autobiographical poem, called Nidod Hasir Oni, which means the one who is sort of like walked around or removed, hastier, I don't know, it's in English, so I don't know what the words are, but hastier only could be the removed poverty. So Ibn Ezra characterized the second period of his life, meaning post 1140, after his son converted out and he went and wandered. So it says, I resided in that place as a stranger, wrote books, and revealed the secrets of knowledge. He is the only example of a wandering scholar who developed an unusually rich literary activity in his roaming existence under the stress of circumstances, and who wrote works of lasting importance. Okay? He sees himself as, you know, a person in exile, but apparently he called himself the Svardi. Here we go. Gives a touching expression of his life, for his love for his fatherland, in an elegy on the persecution by the Almohads, which began in 1142. Interesting. Okay, according to the date that I said, he had left before that, so maybe there was some kind of persecution that pushed him out. I don't know. This is just from the Jewish Encyclopedia. I can't say for sure. He says that... What? Oh, yeah, no, there are a lot of biographies. A lot of that has to do with his poems and dissecting what he wrote. Just in terms of getting his life down, it's very hard. But he enumerates the Spanish and Northern African towns in which the communities fell victims to the persecution. His remark on the commandment concerning the festal bunch of grains, I think that might refer to the lulav, gives a glimpse into the longing for his beautiful native land. Whoever is exiled from Arabian lands to the lands of Edom, meaning Christian Europe, will understand, if he has eyes, the deep meaning of this commandment. I don't know what that means, but presumably it was referring to the vegetation that he enjoyed in Spain. So, interestingly enough, the person, you know, the rabbinic commentaries are not as influential at the time as he was with the secular commentaries, because through his wanderings, he teaches all these different communities the secular knowledge of astronomy and of mathematics. We know him not as that at all. We have other secular knowledge to understand those things, especially since they have progressed since, you know, the 1100s. But he was able to translate things for Jews all over the place and to give them science and to give them mathematics and to give them literature. And at least at the end here, it says he was fitted for this mission as no one else through the versatility of his learning and through his clear and charming Hebrew style. The great compass of his literary activity will be seen from the resume of his works. So, I mean, this just goes through tons of different things that he had. That he wrote down and that he did. So, for instance, he had a philosophy book called Yesod Mora. He has another work in mathematics, astronomy, and astrology, Sefer HaEchad, which talks about numbers. Yesod HaMispar, which is talking about math. Luchot is apparently about astronomy. Sefer HaIbor is about the calendar specifically. The Kli HaNechoshet is apparently something called an astrolabe.
Yeah.
You know what that is?
That's the astrolabe is the...
It reflects the stars or something?
The stars at time. That's how you can calculate the time.
Okay. Interesting.
That was an Arabic thing that came from Istanbul.
Okay. I don't know. Yeah. He has other works that he translated from an astrologer named Mashallah. He has... I don't know what this is even. They could calculate latitude with an astrolabe. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. All right. Oh, the altitude. Not the latitude. The altitude. That makes sense. Oh, both?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Interesting. That's crazy. All right. He also has a lot of Hebrew grammar books. Mosnayim, which talks about... Yeah, he had unbelievable books. Translated a work of somebody else in grammar into Hebrew. Sefer HaYesod, or Yesod Dikduk, which apparently he never finished or was never edited, was also about grammar. He has a book called Zahot or Zachot, which is about linguistic correctness. I don't know what that means. But yeah, and then Safabru Ra, which you quoted before. And then he actually has some grammar little treaties in the middle of his commentaries on Chumash. Yeah, and there are other smaller books also. It's just tremendous. You know, just tremendous, the amount of secular knowledge that he was able to give over in Hebrew. And he's not known for any of it. He's known for his commentary on Chumash. But that was almost like a footnote. I mean, Chas v'Shalom, but that was relatively a footnote to his life's work. His life's work was all of the science in Hebrew and translations that he did for people. He definitely grew up speaking whatever they spoke there. I would have assumed it was Arabic, but I don't know. Either way, but then he obviously has his biblical commentary. And he's not, even though he's very grammatically committed, I mean, he wants to explain things very literally, he also goes into like little other vignettes. There are a couple of things that just, you know, I reminded of from recent Parshiot. Let me find it if I can. The Makkah of Choshech. Yeah, just there's a cute little phrase in there. Let's see if I can find it. Barad. Okay. And Parsigo. Yeah, here it is. V'yamesh Choshech. This is Perek Yud, Pasuk Chaf Aleph and Shmos. So let me see if I can find it here. Kmo lo yamish, he's quoting from Pasuk V'atam, ki yamish kol choshech ha'elam yadua, ve'avo achar av bimenu. There is some kind of thickness that comes from the darkness. V'yesh or mikiu chaser alis, umilas emesh v'lashon ha'kodesh ha'layla sha'avar. Maybe it's referring to the past. V'lashon arvi amas, right, he's quoting from Arabic. Ki ha'shin yitzchalik besamech barov ha'milot, that the shin and the samach are interchangeable when you are switching from Arabic to Hebrew. Kamo shemesh, shemes. V'hine ein tam l'pirusham, says Ibn Ezra, that's not right. Just ein tam, there's no reason to think that. U'lefi da'ati, ki v'yamesh migizrat yimashesh. Yimashesh. V'ein tana bavor shuhu mipale ha'kefel, ki kamohu v'zeh ha'inin yideh v'loim yishun. Right, it's not a double letter word. But okay, either way. V'shava al mitzrim ki mitzrim lashon yachid, mitzrayim lashon yachid, k'mo v'yomer mitzrayim anusa v'ne'atam she'ima she'shu b'yadam ha'chotchech. They could feel with their hands, they could feel the thickness of the darkness. She'kol kach ya'av ki ha'or shel esh lo yidlach. Because the light of fire would not even, it wouldn't kindle. I assume what he means is there's so much moisture in the air that you couldn't even make a fire. V'lo ha'ner v'ha'ed lo re'u ish et achiv lo bo ha'yom v'lo bo ha'nerot. Not with the light of day and not with the light of the candle. And then he says, "Vayet v'lo yadu shai shloshet yamim," and they didn't even know that it was 3 days. El al pi Yisrael shehayalam, or only the Jewish people knew because they had light. V'hine biyam okianos, the okianos river or sea. I don't know. I'm sure that's a real thing. I thought it was near. Okinus? I don't know. It could be just the ocean. Maybe the letters are interchangeable there. Yavochoshech av, from the water, from the sea, you can get this kind of thickness, meaning like from evaporation, you can get that thick fog that comes out of the ocean or from the sea. Shelo yuchal adam lahafresh ben yom ben laila. Sometimes it's so thick, you can't distinguish between day and night. That's how thick fog can get. Sometimes that can last for days if the humidity is such. And he says, "Va'ani ha'yisi shem pamin rabos," and I was there. I don't know what he's talking about. I've heard that it's referring to England, and he was in the London fog. If you're familiar,
yeah.
Eastern, like Eastern,
was
so thick.
That was
thick like pea soup. That's what they say in London. Okay, so he apparently was a world traveler. So he's like, I've been in this kind of thing before. You know, I don't know if it was London or otherwise, but...
It's not like that, no.
So either way, so that's like a cute little vignette that he has. Another interesting thing that he talks about in another place that I saw recently in Bishala, he talks about, and I've quoted this before, he talks about how the Jewish people were unwilling to fight against the Egyptians, not because, you know, the Egyptians scared them, but because they had a complex, an inferiority complex, where the Egyptians were their taskmasters, and even if the Jews outnumbered them by such vast numbers, they nonetheless felt uncomfortable fighting against them because they were their owners, they were their masters, and they couldn't undo that psychology, that psyche. Maybe Stockholm syndrome type of thing. Yeah, that's an interesting point. Maybe in some ways that's what it meant. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, interesting. Either way, so then I'm trying to find that commentary, but I can't find it right now. Hold on. Right, is it over here? It says that they were so afraid. I think it's more trying to find it. Yeah, this has got to be it. Ki atem lo sasum lechol rak tirus yu as shema she yasa lechem hayom ki yesh lismo ech yira machane gadol shal shesh meos elef ish mea rotsim achreim. How could a camp of 600,000 men be afraid of the people chasing them? V'lam lo yulachamu al nafsham, why not fight? V'yal v'nehem hachuva ki hamitrim hayu adonim li Yisrael. The Egyptians were their masters. V'zehador hayotim yitrayim. And this was the actual generation that were slaves. Lamad minu urav lispol ol mitrayim. From their infancy, they understood, just take it from the Egyptians. Just, you got to tolerate slavery from them. V'nafshav shavala, and they were inferior. They felt lowly. V'ech yuchal atol ech madonav. How can we fight against our masters? V'hayu yisron nirpim ve'inam lumadim lumamchama. And they were not trained warriors at all. And even later on, we find that Amalek threatens the Jewish people. Only Hashem could overcome their own inadequacies. Yeah. So it's sort of a fascinating take. I can imagine that on the Parshios of Truma and Tetzava, he has a lot of also interesting commentary about how the materials of the Mishkan were formed that are probably beyond my understanding, because he uses some very intricate language. That's beyond me. But let me see if I can pluck a commentary out from this week's parsha first. Yeah, I don't know if he went into the specifics like that. But it is interesting to note that he has a poem at the beginning of the parsha to start off his commentary. Mm-hmm. Some of the Spanish rabbis did that. The Ramban is famous for doing that before every big sefer. Ibn Ezra apparently did that before parshas. L'das emes im uvav chav yaveh, re'ei kol gviyah l'nechva b'naveh, v'urim v'tumim v'sodam achaveh, v'seter v'seder al atad etaveh. It's like a four-line couplet. You can tell the rhyming scheme. You know, I will show you about, you know, the secrets of the Urim v'Tumim, and in the right, b'seder, what is concealed within the parsha of Yata Tzaveh. So it's very cute how he does that, but it just speaks to his ability, speaks to his skill set. Trying to see if he has any commentaries, short commentaries we can just look at from the parsha, and then we'll call it Vitam. No, that's not one. Try to find a good commentary here. Let's see. Oh, I just thought of another one I like to put in. Yeah. When he talks about the Ofet, the Ephod, he brings like tons of different sections from all over Tanakh, which indicate that there were multiple Ephods, not just one. Yes. Yeah, it's very long pieces here. Analyzing, looking from all over Tanakh and trying to make sense of it. But noticing in all of these, I haven't seen one reference to anything from Chazal. Not one Talmudic reference. It's all just looking and making sense of all of it together. I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to find... yeah, a lot of it is grammatical. So I don't even know how to understand the words that he's using. Trying to find one... Okay, hold on. Where'd it go? Yeah. All right. Yeah. Interesting. He doesn't even try to give his own understanding of things, but he does seem to quote at least Chazal. He doesn't quote from Chazal, but he quotes the opinions of Chazal. When he talks about the Me'il, he talks about whether the pomegranate was the bell or whether there was a pomegranate and then a bell on the outside of the pomegranate, whether it was inside or outside, which is the machlokas. I think the Rashi and the Ramban. They found what? Of the meal? Really?
Yeah, they found was on that, what do you know, I think, a couple of years ago, the archaeologist.
Really?
They found the bells.
Interesting, I never heard that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he goes through a lot of descriptions, a lot of cross references to other places in Tanakh where a lot of these items come up, especially in Nach, where they wore these different clothing, they wore the different ornaments on their heads and everything. So he does a lot of that cross-referencing, tons of psukim in this commentary and this discussion. I should have known it was going to be too complicated for me to even look at.
Yeah.
But either way, for his poems, really?
Yeah.
Eight books? Ava books. Oh, okay. Well, that's probably because it's out of print or something.
Yeah. And there's that. All these other rabbis you've talked to all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I have no idea where he learned.
But who would preserve this work? If he didn't have descended, and you haven't talked about trying to be Shiva.
Yeah.
So.
That is interesting to note. We do know that the Spanish rabbis in particular were pretty well resourced in terms of books,
mm-hmm.
more than other rabbis. We know from the Cairo Geniza that they had tons
mm-hmm.
of books, tons
yeah.
of literature, relatively. I mean, nothing
mm-hmm.
like we have today. But so there might have been, on his part, an effort to preserve them.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure. But certainly he was doing this to educate the public. He wasn't doing it just to keep to himself.
Right.
So he must have
yeah.
given them over
you
to other people, too.
You mentioned that he was associated with a particular Shiva or...
Yeah, right.
Sentence,
right.
You know,
yeah. He does have... I want to say he had a couple students. Who are his students? I don't know if I have this written down somewhere. And I don't know. I thought he had a student or two.
Mm-hmm.
We know a few other Spanish rabbis. Let me look this up. I thought I saw this somewhere. Maybe it was just on English Wikipedia.
Yeah, because you haven't mentioned much. You said students, but some of them.
Yeah.
So
yeah, no, he doesn't really have much. I mean, he wandered most of his life.
Yeah.
He wasn't really... He didn't... Yeah, I don't know. I don't see anything. I'm not seeing who his students were at all. Let me look. I thought I saw maybe it was the Hebrew Wikipedia. I saw it somewhere. I don't want to make it sound like he doesn't have any. Let me see if it's on the Hebrew one. Some people say he actually made it to Israel, but it's unsubstantiated apparently. His yard site is the first day of Adar. First day of Adar, he was 75 years old. I don't see any other students that came from him. I don't know. I don't see any. Who were the students of Gavanser? There must have been. I feel like that's a good riddle or trivia.
Yeah.
Who were the students of Gavanser? I don't know. I thought I saw it.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah, you talk, it doesn't sound like he started the yeshiva, or he went from one to another, or he had descendants. Basically, on his own.
I can't find anything. There's got to be. All right. We'll leave the class off with a question. Who were the students of the Ibn Ezra?
Who preserved his work?
Who preserves his works? Who would have kept on to them? There's what?
There's a lot of good, I mean, good.
Yeah, no, he's got a lot of things, but I'm not seeing any students.
No. No. People didn't keep the extra students, something comes up.
Yeah, right. Either way, all right, you know, Sarachian, we don't know who the Ibn Ezra's students were, if he had any. But he certainly has plenty of works that people have learned from. So he has literary students, if not literal students, people that have learned his work, that continue to learn his work. And it's one of those commentaries that's made its way into the Chumash, but it requires a certain aptitude to even learn it. A lot of the other commentaries, like Rashi and the Rashbam, they're accessible because they're pretty straightforward. His are, you know, incisive. You have to know grammar. You have to know the words that he's using and what he means when he references them. get that sometimes in Rashi with his grammar commentaries too. But generally, the Ibn Ezra, an enigmatic character, controversial in some ways. We didn't even get into that because I don't know about it. And it has to do with pantheism, if you're familiar with, you know, God being in everything, everything.
Yeah.
Sort of like a precursor to a similar Hasidic concept, but not for now.
Right.
But either way, he's known for his philosophy, his science, his grammar, his mathematics, and he wrote a Parish of Flemish when he was older,
yeah.
That kind of thing. It was fascinating just to learn about someone who's so different,
yeah.
Right? You know, we have a lot of, as Meir was pointing out before, we have a lot of molds, you know, paths that the rabbis take. They grew up, their father was a rabbi,
yeah.
they were sent away to a rabbi for training, they learned in the yeshiva, they
yeah.
married some wealthy person that, you know, provided for them to have a yeshiva,
yeah.
And then they have a lot of students, and then they get promoted, and then they have the bigger position, and a bigger position, and a bigger position, and sooner or later, they're a mainstream rabbi. Ibn Ezra was not like that.
Yeah,
he was a secular scholar, that also happened to use those tools, use those skills to teach people not just secular subjects, which
yeah.
the Jewish people needed in other places outside of Spain, but also Torah subjects,
mm-hmm.
to bring that skill set into Torah. And, you know, that's the greatest form of Torah umada, if you will, that we have to understand knowledge in a broader sense and being able to bring that into Torah and make the world a better place for it. Anyways, a lot of enigma, besides the fact that, you know, I didn't have my notes, but also because we don't have much documented history about him. Certainly a fascinating character, a unique character, perhaps, you know, one of the more unique characters that we've seen thus far in the series. But nonetheless, that's the Ibn Ezra in a nutshell. And now that you understand that, you know, next time you hear the Ibn Ezra says, you much better understand, oh, you mean the astronomer?
Okay.
You mean the mathematician? You mean the scientist? That Ibn Ezra? Yes.
Okay.
He was also a rabbi.
Okay,
all right.
Okay,
all right. Everyone be well. If you can figure out who was a student of the Ibn Ezra, I think we'd all appreciate it.
Yeah,
I would say next best, but David's probably before Google.